Welcome to Sustainable Sessions, hosted by yours truly, Lucas and Lauren. Episode 24, featuring Tova Davidson.
So welcome to Sustainable Sessions. We have Tova Davidson, who works for Sustainable Region Waterloo. So if you want to just give like a brief overview and introduction of who you are and what your role is with the city.
Sure. So I am the executive director at Sustainable Waterloo Region, and the work that we do is organizational and community level sustainability. So we work with businesses and other kinds of organizations like municipalities and hospitals and not-for-profits, that kind of thing, to help them figure out what their impact, their material impact on the environment is, measure it, set targets to reduce it, make changes in culture and operations to try to improve their impact on the environment in ways that are good for their organization. So it's a dual impact at very least, economic and environmental together. We also work at community level sustainability, where we will work on things like what is the carbon footprint of all of Waterloo Region? How do we create a target to reduce that? How do we create a plan and a strategy to reduce that? Engage all the partners. Our areas of expertise all relate to climate change, and they are in energy, which for us includes waste and water, mobility and transportation, and then green buildings. And we typically work as a strategic intermediary, so bringing together our expertise with other experts in the community to try to solve problems of the community that are scalable and usable beyond just the boundaries of Waterloo Region.
Wow.
A little bit of everything. We love it.
And my role, I'm the executive director, so that means I'm the only employee of the board. So I do both strategic work and making sure the organization's running properly.
Wow.
That's super cool. Well, just, I guess, to touch on the strategic component, obviously that's so interesting. You guys are definitely very forward-thinking as a municipality, at least compared to some all over the country. Do you guys do a lot of work with, like, the province of Ontario, or how do you guys kind of source a lot of the research that you guys are using for when you implement these ideas?
So we're an independent not-for-profit, but work really closely with the municipality. So our work is actually really interesting because we're able to sort of do our own direction, our own strategy, but then we work so closely because we are a regional organization. We do work with the province and the work that they're doing, and we do some government relations work to make sure that we're in line with what the province or the feds are doing. We also are part of some communities within the environmental sector where we work with them to know what's going on with those groups. So people like Green Economy Canada, which is a not-for-profit that was started actually by Sustainable Waterloo Region. We started another not-for-profit to scale the work that we do. So we then learn from them what are other communities doing, or the Clean Air Alliance, Clean Air Partnership, all of those kinds of groups as well.
Awesome.
And I guess just before we kind of maybe even talk about some of those projects, can we go back maybe more into how did you get into this type of role, and like, what's your background and how did you get into all of this?
So as I was telling you before we started recording, I grew up with hippie parents and have always been the green kid, like my whole life. Picking up litter drove my mother crazy, took us forever to get anywhere. So it's been sort of in my DNA my whole life. In terms of official career path, I did a master's degree in philosophy because I liked it. And my dad was an educator and believed that you should study what you love, and had to get a job out of university while I was still in my master's program, actually. So I started working at Rogers when it was a cell phone company called Cantel AT&T. And I did communications there and public relations, and then decided I didn't want to stay commuting. So I ended up working for a local marketing agency and became vice president there over a 12-year tenure. It was called the Letter M. But around about 7 years ago, I just thought, you know, this is not what I imagined my life being, as great as the Letter M is and was. I wanted to do something that sort of fit with my core values. So I just started keeping my eyes open. And when this role came up, the executive director here at Sustainable Waterloo Region, I thought, you know what, it's working with businesses on strategy to meet their goals. It's what I do in the marketing firm as the vice president. I really did believe very strongly in organizational sustainability as a principle for how are we going to get to the cleaner, better future for everybody. And so I just sent a resume and said, look, I kind of do this kind of work and you're looking for this. And no, I don't have a background in environment, but I believe in it and I know stuff and I'm smart. So can we chat? And Here I am 7 years later.
That's incredible. And I think that's kind of like so interesting that it really resonated back to your earlier past where you had this upbringing that was really environmentally conscious. Since you've taken on this role, obviously, I'm sure you've began to research a lot more yourself and like learn about more how you make an impact. What are some new things that you've learned since you started this new position, and how has it kind of changed your life and its trajectory?
Things that I've learned. Well, I now can explain the scopes of carbon emissions pretty easily and quickly. I've learned all kinds of stuff that way. The technical stuff I certainly had to learn. I've also learned what it is that is the barrier to a more sustainable future for people as well as organizations. And I would say that that is culture, not technology. We already have the technology for a completely carbon-free future if we had the cultural will to implement it and to make those changes. And it doesn't have to be a future of deprivation. It actually can be a better, brighter future for everybody. I've learned that the thing that my teachers didn't like about me as a kid is my superpower now, and it's all the energy that I bring into a room. And then there's all these interesting facts that most people don't know, but things like Canada has the highest emissions per capita of the entire G20. We are the worst polluters in the world per person. And most people have no idea. Or that Canada is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world. Most people have no idea. Or that a kilowatt of energy from natural gas or gasoline has 10 times the greenhouse gas emissions that an equivalent kilowatt of electricity is in Ontario. Some of those really basic things that if the average person knew, they would understand why some of the things we're asking them to do make such an impact.
Yeah, and even if you could touch a little bit more, because you said you learned all the carbon terminology kind of in layman terms. I know that's one thing that I didn't necessarily know. So maybe if you just want to like explain for the listeners just some basic stuff that you think everyone should know.
And if they want to learn more, like where they can kind of go and explore some of this stuff a little bit further too.
Okay, so first, I think that people don't understand that climate change comes from greenhouse gases, and greenhouse gases come from energy. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. So the energy that we use to make things, to move, to live, to stay warm, any of those things, or to grow our food, et cetera, that is what creates carbon change, climate change, because it creates greenhouse gases. There's more than one greenhouse gas. Most people talk carbon, but what they mean, if you're being technical, is CO2e, carbon equivalent, and that there are other greenhouse gases like methane, which is a 25 times CO2e. It's more impactful on the environment by 25 times. There are three scopes of carbon emissions. Most people don't know that. And it's really on how we do carbon accounting. It is the globally accepted and used way of understanding our carbon scoping and measurement. The first scope of carbon emissions is scope one, and it is what belongs wholly to you. So it is what you actually burn yourself. So in an average home for the average person, mostly it's gasoline and natural gas. So what are you heating your house with? That kind of thing. The second scope is something that is a little further removed from you, but that you have control over. So think in, for most people, that is their electricity use. You don't generate your electricity, but you control exactly how much you use, what the equipment is, when it gets turned on, turned off, et cetera. That's scope two emissions. And in most programs and most frameworks, scope one and scope two emissions are required for reporting. And that's the case for us as well. Scope three, the third, is even further removed from you. They are the scope one and scope two emissions of somebody else, but you've had a role to play and therefore have some responsibility for it. The easiest one that I've used to explain this is air travel. The fuel from that flight belongs as scope one emissions to the airline, but you bought the ticket. So you don't control what plane it is, what route it goes on, how well it's maintained, et cetera, but you did buy the ticket. So it's your scope three emission and their scope one emission. And the reason we do this is so that you don't get double counting of emissions and you don't get double counting for the changes that are made. So if I fly less, but the plane still goes, that doesn't mean the emissions have changed. My scope three emissions are different, but the global emissions haven't changed. If you want to, so those are, I think, the really basics.
No, that was so cool.
If you wanted to learn more on that, just Google it. I mean, it's really common knowledge. You don't have to go to anything specialized, just carbon scoping. Super simple.
That's very interesting. And I think that's something that our viewers will really appreciate too when they try to really understand. Because like we said, like sometimes you're just bombarded with facts and ideas and you really have to break them down to truly understand what the information is. And for, I guess, our younger audience that might not be, they might be in elementary school for that matter, like, you don't want stuff going over their heads, but they want to understand exactly what carbon emissions are and how it, these numbers are calculated.
Yeah, so and even for like carbon sinks too, I know that's kind of like the other side of the issue, that we're not sucking in those greenhouse gases. I don't know if you want to chat on that a little.
Yeah, so all a carbon sink is a place that the carbon can be taken out of the atmosphere and stored somewhere. And the very best carbon sink, carbon capture, that's the other way people talk about it, carbon capture tool that we have is trees. That's why deforestation matters so much, because trees, as they're growing, absorb carbon because they need it to grow. All living things need carbon to grow. Carbon's not the enemy. It's just the quantity that we have is too much. Mm-hmm. And so the trees absorb the carbon, release oxygen for us to breathe, and then they hold on to that carbon until that tree dies and either decomposes or burns. It will hold on to that carbon. And so planting more trees and reforestation as opposed to deforestation is so important. It also helps with things like climate adaptation, slowing down wind, slowing down water. Reforestation means better, you know, ecological diversity, habitat renewal, all of those good things. But if you're just talking climate change, it still matters.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to kind of backtrack to a little bit, because I know you mentioned that methane is 25 times what the CO2 is. And so I know like some of the biggest, driving causes of methane would be in the agriculture and food industry. And that's something where we had a previous guest that talked about food waste. And it's very interesting to think about the idea that, like, not only is it important to just make sure you're putting your food in a compost to allow it to get composted, but if you don't do that, it's going to emit 25x compared to regular carbon. And then on top of that, if you had properly composted that, we could have harvested some of that methane energy and been able to like turn that into, it's like, we had the opportunity to be so, so good, and it became so, so worse because we didn't, if you don't compost. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's one of those things that people don't understand, but it's a kind of a simple science thing. Like, I think you could teach it in grade school, anaerobic digestion versus aerobic digestion. Anaerobic digestion creates methane, aerobic digestion creates carbon. Carbon is less impactful, so that's why you have to compost it. Even better, you go to an anaerobic digester and then harvest the methane, make it into electricity, and then you have a virtuous cycle. But if you can't do that, that green box in your kitchen is really important.
Yeah, that's awesome.
One question that I had for you, going back to kind of like all the projects that you've worked on, are there any that just really resonated with you and you just like learned so much from one particular experience, or maybe like a few of them?
Yeah.
So the biggest project that's happened since I've been here at Sustainable Waterloo Region is the Evolve One building. Have you heard about that?
Yes, I've been there. I actually had a cool job and I went to go visit. It's so cool.
So that building, the idea for the building actually came out of Sustainable Waterloo Region's strategic plan. So we did a strategic plan in 2013, went out to the community as we do with everything and asked what was the big thing we should be working on. And they talked a lot about there being a Center for Sustainability Excellence. That was kind of the original name for it. And it wasn't only a demonstration site of what's possible in green buildings, but it was also like a home for sustainability so that organizations could come together to solve the problems that are facing our community in terms of a cleaner, greener future. And so we went away and we did a business case. About what would be included. Could we make it work? Is there any benefit to doing this? Because everything we do, we want to be scalable and replicable. We don't want to make the Disney World of buildings. And we found that, yeah, it was. So we went out to the community to see who would like to work with us on it and found some partners in the developer, who's the Cora Group, the landholder, which is the David Johnson Research and Tech Park, and one of the tenants, EY Canada. And those four organizations, along with us, worked together for 3 years, meeting every 3 weeks for breakfast for 2 hours to move this project forward. And we did a feasibility study, which is available on our website, which shows you exactly how to build a building like this. How do you build? And it is certified as Canada's very first net positive energy, carbon neutral multi-tenant office building. And it was done entirely within the developer's approved budget. And it's completely scalable and replicable. There's no reason the development industry shouldn't just do that as the standard, because it's a good business case as well.
That's so incredible. I'm actually going to like read that myself. Like, I'm really interested in real estate. So that's so interesting to hear. Is there anything like of I know, you know, obviously I'll read the report to learn a little bit more, but if you could talk a little bit to some of the maybe construction materials that allowed this to be so impactful, and or some of the unique things that maybe the average developer is not really focusing on but should definitely pay more attention to.
So the thing that I learned is there's three stages of building a green building. And the first one is the least interesting and the least sexy of all of them. And it's core and shell. So high levels of insulation, really good windows. This building has triple glazed windows. So it's three pieces of glass instead of two. Really strong insulation value and the correct window to wall ratio. So some buildings are all glass, which environmentally is terrible because they're really leaky. So it's got the right window to wall ratio. And when you're in the building, it still looks really bright. Most people think they wouldn't notice that it's not just wall to wall windows. The second is the mechanical systems in the building. So making sure that you're using as little energy as you need to. So that could be things like every light is LED, or the heating system uses a variable refrigerant flow, a VRF system, which instead of, most people don't know this, most commercial buildings are heating and cooling the building at the same time all year round. So wow. The furnace and the air conditioning are both running all the time because one room is hot and one room is cold. And so it's heating one and cooling the other. Instead, this system takes the hot air from the room that's too hot and delivers it to the cold room. So it's called it. That makes good sense, right? Yeah, so use those. And only after you've done those things, then you get to things like renewable energy, geothermal systems, solar panels to generate the energy. And the reason you do that is those first two reduce the amount of generation you need. Mm-hmm. So if it's well insulated and you're using systems that are really efficient, then you need to generate less energy. So in that building, some of the systems that are there, there's a geothermal system, but it's not a traditional closed loop. It's an open source. So it actually sucks water out of an aquifer, takes the heat from the water and returns the water down. So there's only one borehole to take it and one to return it. So it's not all these holes in the ground. It has that VRF system. There are solar panels, not only on the roof, but covering the parking lot, which is super cool. And a local company called VCT Group designed the stands for them. And then my favorite feature in the whole building is the solar wall. And a solar wall is an exterior wall that's about 18 inches from the actual facade of the building. And behind that space, it's perforated, behind that space, the air heats up and then it's sucked into the heating system and delivered as warm, passively generated heat to the building. Mm-hmm. And it was seen almost as what I call eco bling, like you put it on, but it's not really gonna have much impact, but you do it because it looks good. But in fact, the day we did the opening for the space that our offices are located in, it was minus 15, it was in February, and it was windy and chilly, but really sunny. The universities were sending people home because they couldn't get enough natural gas into their buildings to heat the space to keep people warm. And our entire heating system had been turned off because the solar wall was heating the 110,000 square feet of the whole building.
That's incredible.
Passive heating.
You're like, not us. You're like, we're here.
Well, and it's completely passive. No energy generated at all.
No, that's so interesting. And I think like going back to the initial point that you said about like the insulation, I think that's just such an obvious thing that it, like even from a business standpoint, it just makes so much sense to make that upfront investment, make sure stuff is totally insulated properly. But then to your point too, like if you have strategic windows that are of a good size, you don't need like the ceiling to floor windows that are just leaking out all this excess heat essentially. And really at the end of the day, if it doesn't change the employee's perspective or like their enjoyment in the building, it's a crazy cost saving. Yeah.
What's interesting is that good windows make your employees happier. And if they're smaller, they're happier because they're not cold or too hot at work. One of the major things we hear from the members in some of our programs is that their employees are uncomfortable at work because it's too cold or it's too hot. And then they want to turn up the furnace or bring in space heaters, that kind of thing. So if you've done proper insulation and really good windows, you're actually creating healthier, more productive employees. So it doesn't just return in your energy bills, it also returns in your human resources.
Yeah, and just kind of like diving a little bit more into, because you said you chat with people in the community. How big is that kind of like market research? And are there any kind of common themes that you've seen throughout the different projects of what people say? I just want to get some more feedback on that a little bit.
Yeah, so we're always talking to our network, and actually we're in the process right now of reaching out to do another set of sort of community consultation for what's the next big transformational idea that we want to see happen here that we need to do in Waterloo Region. The things that we're seeing are a lot of sort of shifting culture. So we do a lot of work in culture of sustainability, not just the technical side, and that's the harder part. And we're seeing a lot of sort of energy system, fuel switching, that kind of thing. Active transportation is becoming really big. We, in partnership with Reef Green Solutions, do the community-wide carbon footprint, and we know that 49% of our carbon footprint comes from transportation, driving cars. So we need to change that. 49%, crazy, right? That's of the domestic, like the locally produced energy. So things like our diets is not integrated into that because we don't eat food that's grown here exclusively, but that's of locally produced. So that's a big one. Transportation shifts, active transportation, as well as electrification and public transit. That's a big piece. And then just looking at our energy system, how do we change energy systems, heat pumps, air source heat pumps, or all of those pieces, and enabling organizations and individuals to make the sort of shift and to understand that the vision we're going towards, the changes we want to make, mean a better community, not taking things away from people. There's a real fear in the environmental, for those who are not in the movement, that we're taking things away from people, that we're making your life sort of scarce and harsh, and not at all. The idea is that it'd be better, actually.
No, I think that's a good way to look at it too. I think there are some people that genuinely like perceive it that way. And I think if you could kind of reorient it and get them to understand it from a more business standpoint and from the environmental standpoint. Yeah, make the case to them. Like it's really hard for them to justify good ideas and go against your arguments if they're airtight. So that's very interesting.
There's actually an interesting business case I would love to share with you. It's about the sort of shining star of sustainability network in Waterloo Region, the one who gets talked about most, Verifarm. Have you heard of them?
No, I haven't.
The name sounds a little bit familiar now that I think of it, but I couldn't like put my head on what the offering.
So Verifarm is a steel fabricator in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And it's run by a couple, Paul and Shona Rack. They own the company, and they had a daughter, I think probably about 12 or 13 years ago now. And Paul had a realization that the business he was running was essentially killing his daughter's future as a steel fabricator. And he decided that no, he wasn't going to do that anymore. And he was going to change the business. And he made a commitment to make the business carbon free, completely carbon free. He did this through the program that we run, the Regional Sustainability Initiative. His wife, Shona, is an accountant, and so she required him to do it in ways that were good for the business. And it happened just before the economic downturn of 2008-09, and the steel industry was really impacted by that. He undertook what he calls his 100 projects, and he did these 100 projects, and he had to make a business case for all of them so that there was a good economic return on them. And over the 10 years, he actually did it. So he took his business 82%. He reduced what's called an organic reduction, which means he actually changed something and he uses less. He generates less. The remainder he buys offsets for, but he's still working on getting rid of those. And at the same time, he never laid anybody off. They doubled the business's size. He says he saved over $1 million in energy costs. And it looks like a steel fabricating business. It doesn't look any different than anywhere else. He doesn't have solar panels, none of those things that everyone expects a sustainable business to have. And I love to tell, people think, oh, he's have done all these really expensive projects. No, because he had to make a business case for them all, remember. Mm-hmm. So the project that I love to tell the most is that as a steel fabricator, he has loading bay doors. Have either of you ever worked in a place with a loading bay?
No, but like I know what you mean though by those doors. I can imagine.
Giant doors, yeah. Right? So he has these giant doors. And there's people opening them and closing them, getting, you know, materials in and shipping final product out. And he was having a terrible time getting them to shut the loading bay doors because the heating or air conditioning was flying out the doors, just environmentally terrible. So he started with showing people what are the numbers, what is the impact, didn't work. They didn't shut the doors. He tried to appeal to their environmental sense because he's built a culture of sustainability. No, didn't get them to shut the doors. He had people ask him to, like, they had technologies they wanted him to put in, like an air curtain, which is quite expensive. He didn't want to do that because he couldn't make the business case for it. But Paul is very, very smart and innovative. So instead, he had an electrician come in. And he put what's called a kill switch on the doors. So when the door opens, the heating and air conditioning turns off, which means the people working in the building get cold or hot, and then they shut the door.
That's so smart. I mean, it's
he said it cost him like $1,300 or something, not a whole lot, but it totally worked.
Smallest investment, but like the biggest impact.
That's so interesting too, like just getting the employees to really experience it. And then when they're, you know, they need the heat, like they're going to start shutting the door. That's so cool.
He said that the people working at the door sometimes would dress for the weather, but the people behind him couldn't because they were working on the line. So they were wearing safety clothes or whatever. And if they're too hot or too cold, they're like, hey, buddy, shut the door. It's cold. So smart.
That's so smart and so easy. And I think like when you think about a lot of these, like, I guess more traditional businesses, like I don't think these kind of little things would really come to the forefront of their mind when they're trying to think about sustainability. But something as little as that really can make such a profound impact over like 10, 20, 30 years of operations.
Good too that Paul, right? Is that his name? He's a transformational leader. Like he was looking to make that impact. And that's what I think we need more so now, more than ever in organizations, people coming forward and thinking about those types of solutions.
Yeah. And even within the network, like think about it. I'm telling you his story. Someone might hear that story and inspire someone else to go, wait a minute, I can do this. He saved $1 million. I want to save $1 million.
No, for sure. And that's what this podcast is for too. We really want to inspire and like share this as much as we can too. I guess to even build on that story, like that was so inspirational, but going forward, what are some new projects that, and I mean, obviously disclose what you guys can, but what are some new things that you guys are looking forward to, let's say from like 2021 and onward?
Oh, well, I have to tell you, the pandemic has really made it clear that for me, the key right now of sustainability is intersectionality, that we don't work in a silo. I am a fairly natural system thinker, and I don't think that we need to make this change for the bugs and the bunnies and the trees. That sustainability action actually is justice and diversity and equity and inclusion and like it's everything. Everything is tied into one and we can't do them separate. And so things like we have integrated some work with actually a researcher at Laurier, Manuel Reimer.
Oh, he's my Chandler professor this semester as well. He's great.
He's great. And we actually are doing two things with him. One is his culture of sustainability.